Sorry for the couple Wednesday hiatus there. We were out of town on vacation, and now we're back, and it's good to be with you once again. And I imagine that's kind of how the summer is, in most churches anyway. People are in and out, and I imagine that you're in and out over the summer. And I'm glad to see you here tonight as we pick up where we left off from 2 weeks, I guess now 3 weeks ago, in our time together. We discussed a lot last time, and I'm certainly not naive enough to think that everyone who was here 3 weeks ago remembers everything I said at that time. I hardly remember everything I said at that time. And so why don't I take just a moment tonight to sort of get us back up to speed on where we're going in this entire lecture series, a little bit about what we talked about 3 weeks ago, and then we'll jump into our material tonight. To start with, make sure you do have an outline. I see them on the chair here in the back. Feel free to slip out and get one if you don't have one. It'll help you track with where we're going. But let's start a little bit of an introduction and review. Keep in mind that at this point in our time together, we're still on this topic of methodology. We're still asking the question, how do I go about arguing? How do I frame my discussion with my non-Christian friend? Now, remember, from the very beginning, that's been a very intentional way of doing this time. This class together. Instead of just jumping into sort of the facts of the world out there or individual arguments for particular tenets of the Christian faith, we want to step back and ask, well, okay, how do you structure your argument in general? How do you think about non-belief in the broader, bigger picture? How do we argue for the Christian faith on the macro level, not just on the micro level? And so that's what we've been discussing for the last bit of time together. In fact, this is our last time that we'll be discussing this topic of argumentative method. Starting next week, we'll be getting into the actual specific questions of the faith. Things like the existence of God, the resurrection of Jesus. Eventually, we'll get into the problem of evil. We'll talk about the reliability of the Bible and things like this. But here, we're going to sort of try to wrap up tonight, at least broad strokes, this idea of structure and methodology to the argument. Now, you may also remember from 3 weeks ago that one of the things I said is that you'll be foggy about this at first. And I imagine after 3 weeks, you're even more foggy than you were 3 weeks ago. But nonetheless, I imagine that many of you will hear this for the first time. If you were here before and you think, okay, I'm sort of getting it, but maybe not. And I encourage you to realize that it's really over the time together that you begin to pick up on this as a whole. So what was our argument from last time? You'll remember when we talk with our non-Christian friend, our job is not simply sort of go into individual micro discussions about individual facts of Christianity, but look at things on the macro level. And you'll recall that our argument had two parts to it. Sort of what we called sort of the negative argument, and then also what we called the sort of positive argument of Christianity. And this was our 1-2 punch, if you remember. No matter what the non-Christian beliefs are, no matter what the worldview is, whether you're dealing with a Mormon or an atheist, agnostic, Hindu, doesn't really matter. When you're talking to that person, all our argumentative structure will look two ways. First, we're going to go on the offensive and talk about his worldview, and then we're going to go on the sort of more positive side and talk about the Christian worldview. And if you remember from a period of time ago, what our macro claim was is simply this. We're going to argue to our non-Christian friend that his worldview has all kinds of problems with it. We want to go inside that world and do what we called a reductio ad absurdum, which is to reduce his worldview to absurdity, to show that if the world was really as he says it is, if there really was no God, or if there were multiple gods like Mormonism, or whatever it happens to be, if the world was really like he says it is, let me show you where that would lead us. It would lead us to absolute irrationality. Why? Because every worldview has to account for what we call the preconditions of intelligibility. You remember what those were? There's three of them. The laws of logic, moral norms, and then the uniformity of nature. And again, last time I didn't get to get into all these in their sort of intricate detail, but these are the main things that they have to account for. We're going to say, look, you can't have a coherent worldview without at least these three things. You can't even think at all without the laws of logic. You can't have any sort of coherence in your life without some sort of moral norms telling you what's right and wrong. Everybody in the worldview has a view about what's right and wrong. In fact, your non-Christian friend is often telling you that you're wrong. So clearly he has some standard for right and wrong in his system. Where does he get it from? How does he know what's right and wrong? You want to ask those questions. And why does the world work in such a predictable manner? And when he lives, how does he know the future will be like the past? Our non-Christian friend lives like that all the time. Why? Because he has to, otherwise he'd have an irrational life. But at the end of the day, he can't account for that. So we want to ask about his worldview. Now remember, it doesn't matter what the worldview is, because as we'll see today, every worldview eventually is going to break down, even the ones that look like they've got some coherence to them. The hardest views to break down are the ones that look the most like Christianity. That's interesting, isn't it? Now, if you think about the worldviews that are very different from Christianity, they're easier to attack. Atheism. What are the worldviews that are hardest to get at? The ones that try to look as much like us as they can. And I will argue a little bit later that the Muslim faith is the one that comes the closest to being what's sort of a Christian sort of copy. Okay, after we've shown his worldview has no grounds for knowledge and rationality, what is our claim? Christianity can provide the foundations for these things. So we can provide the foundations for logic, we can think straight, because we have a mind of God that we follow, moral norms, and we also have a grounds for the uniformity of nature. Now, this is the macro structure. We want to say that, look, I can have a coherent system, I can have a rational life, Christianity provides the foundation for those things. Now, that doesn't mean in the midst of this discussion that you don't ever talk about micro questions. Of course you do. In the midst of this, you may talk about micro questions like the reliability of the Bible. Now, when I say that's a micro question, I don't mean that's an unimportant question. I just mean it's a sort of sub-question that you need to look at, and you're going to sort of get into that later. I'll talk about that. You're going to get into questions about the historicity of Jesus, or get into other types of things like science. We'll talk about that in here. None of that really derails the overall argument, though. Still, you want to make sure that whenever you're dealing with those evidences, you deal with them in light of the respective worldviews. Remember, your non-Christian friend is going to accept or decline certain types of evidence because of what he already believes in his worldview. So you're going to want to address those things when the time comes. Okay, that's the sort of catch-up time in our methodology. And I know there's still a lot of blanks to fill in here. That's what is very normal at this stage of the game. What do we want to do tonight that's different? Well, tonight, if you look at your outline there, see number 4 at the top, we're still on methodology. This is number 4, sort of taking it to the streets. What we want to do tonight is put a little more practical meat on the bones of this evening. And so I'm going to talk through various things tonight, practical thoughts, suggestions, steps. I'm going to take us into some hypothetical sort of micro conversations with your non-Christian friend. We're going to talk through about how to make this more tangible in your day-to-day discussions. So hopefully we can put a little bit more sort of substance to this before our evening is out today. Then starting next week, we'll get into sort of the macro questions like the existence of God and things of this nature. Okay, let's go ahead and jump into the main stuff tonight then. There's 4 main categories here, 4 exhortations, if you will, 4 tips, 4 suggestions, however you want to take tonight, of how to enter in and how to think about you as an apologist as you interact with your non-Christian friends. First tonight, be theological, not just philosophical. It's interesting in discussions of apologetics, people have the impression, it's interesting to see this, that the way you become a good apologist is you become a good philosopher first. And that you think, if I'm going to become a good apologist, I have to learn philosophy, then I can become a good apologist, and I have to learn philosophical language, think in philosophical categories, talk like a philosopher, read philosophers, and then I can really argue in an effective manner. Now, some of that's true, and certainly philosophy helps substantially in apologetics, and certainly it's worth studying, and certainly some of our greatest apologists have been philosophers. However, I want us to rethink tonight the role of philosophy versus theology in our studies. Many of you out here tonight may have never studied philosophy in any formal capacity. That's fine. Some of you may get the chance to do that, and that would be fine. I would encourage it. Studying philosophy is very helpful if you're going to do apologetics. But it's not necessarily the most central thing. I would argue tonight the most central thing for you, oddly enough, maybe in some people's mind, is actually understanding the theology of the Bible as the most important grounds for your apologetic. Now, why is that the case? Well, look at point A there in your outline. You can see there in point A, the reason this is the case is that to compare worldviews with the unbeliever, you must first know your own. And remember, when we talk with a non-Christian friend, ultimately, it's a macro question of comparing overall systems, right? We're comparing overall worldviews with a non-Christian friend. We're not just quibbling about individual isolated facts. And since we're comparing worldviews and talking about his worldview and our worldview, one of the most important things we need to know is the worldview we're actually defending. You have to actually know the Christian system so you can see how it would contrast to other systems. Now, some of us have this idea in our minds that if I'm going to be a good apologist, I have to learn other systems. So you have to become an expert on Hinduism, or an expert on Islam, or expert on modern versions of atheism. And certainly those things are useful and helpful to do. But again, tonight, I want to argue that the worldview that matters the most for you as a Christian is not the Hindu worldview, or the Mormon worldview, but the Christian worldview. The reason that we're not the apologists we need to be is because we actually don't know our own faith well enough. In fact, we don't know it well enough to begin to articulate how it differs from our non-Christian worldview, our friend's non-Christian worldview, and understand what are the major tenets in the Christian system. And so sort of the first exhortation tonight is to think about what makes our own Christian worldview distinctive and unique. So in your own mind, what you need to ask yourself is, could I, in maybe 5 minutes, explain sort of the core distinctives of Christian theology? What makes Christianity unique compared to anything else in the world? What are sort of the unique tenets about our system that make us different from, say, Mormonism, or even Judaism, or maybe Islam? Now, there's several that come to mind. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time working through these, but let me just mention a few of them to you tonight. Some core theological things that most of you would know, and since I know this church a good bit from the various folks I know that go here, I imagine that you would probably be more educated in this fact than maybe more, maybe than some other churches. But nonetheless, let me just mention a few things that are key here about the Christian worldview that we'd want to get straight if we're going to understand it and defend it. First, the very nature of God. What is God like? My son, who now is 6 years old, a year and a half ago or so, I was kind of putting him in bed at night, tucking him in, and he's a big question asker. He always asks questions. Maybe you have a child like that, ask you questions about everything. My son asks me questions about everything. Well, one night, I'm tucking him in, and he kind of looks up and says, "Dad, what's God like?" Now, there's a good bedtime question, right? Well, how long do you have? You know, let me tell you. Let me pull out Burkhoff or Bob Inc., and we'll talk about the doctrine of God. That's not really what he was asking for, right? It's funny, if someone asks you the question, what God is like, do you have an answer? You know, we think we could answer it quickly until you really have to. Realize, well, I'm not sure I know what God is like. Well, one of the things that makes the Christian worldview unique, just erase these circles for the moment, and we'll come back to this a little bit later. One of the things that makes the Christian worldview unique, as far as what God is like, is something I mentioned last week. That God is what we call a personal absolute, the Christian God. A personal absolute. God, the Christian God, is distinctive. The Christian version of theism is unique. Why? Because we're the only system in the world that has a coherent version of God that's a personal absolute. What do we mean by that? Well, we mean, first of all, that God is not just a force in the world. God is not just some energy field. God is not Star Wars, the force, right, where he just kind of has this power in the universe. No, God is an individual. He's a person, and as a person, he relates with and has covenant interaction with his people. And so to say that God is a personal God already just completely distinguishes you from vast amounts of religious thought in the world, particularly Eastern religions. Eastern religions have a God, but he's not a personal God. He's not a being like we would have the Christian God be. So he's distinctive, then he relates to his people, he's a person, and he have a relationship with him. But the second thing about God is that he's absolute. In other words, he's transcendent in his authority. He has all power, all might, all knowledge, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent. God is transcendent in his nature. Now, what's interesting is that you have a lot of gods out there in the world that are personal, but not transcendent. I'll give you an example. Mormonism. The gods of Mormonism are personal. You can have a relationship with them. The problem is they're not transcendent because there's multiple gods. The gods of the Romans were this way. You look at the gods in the Greco-Roman world, they were the Greek gods, were very personal. You could have a relationship with one of the Greek gods. The problem is they weren't absolute. They didn't rule the whole world. They didn't have complete and utter power. They were not transcendent and holy. They were limited. What you whittle down all the worldviews at the end of the day, what you end up realizing is there's only a few that even claim to have a God that is both personal and absolute. Now, you may wonder, why does this all matter for apologetics? Simply for this reason. It's only this kind of God that can provide the foundations for knowledge. It's only this kind of God that can provide the foundations that we talked about that I just erased, moral norms, laws of logic, and so forth. Let's take moral norms, for example. Moral norms, only way you get those is if you have a God that's a personal absolute. So if you have moral absolutes here, or moral norms, obviously you have to have a God that's transcendent, absolute, and all-powerful. Otherwise, the norms themselves aren't absolute. The gods of Mormonism can't have moral absolutes because they can make their own moral laws, but then another God on his planet may make his moral laws, maybe the exact opposite. The only way you actually have moral norms is if you have a God who can enforce them, and a God who's transcendent enough to implement them. But you also have to have a God who's personal. Why? Because they're morals. Morals, by definition, imply relationships. Rocks and trees don't require you to, don't impose moral obligations on people. Matter, just physical things, don't impose moral obligations on people. To have moral obligations implies some ought in relationship to another person. Where does that come from? It comes from, obviously, an individual. How do we know God is a person? One is that we have moral norms in the universe that tell us that He, in fact, is a personal God. So you can only have a coherent worldview with a personal absolute. What does that mean? The next question is, which worldview can provide it? Now, we don't have time to get into all that discussion tonight, but at the end of the day, there's really only two contenders. Christianity, Judaism is sort of a subset there, right? Obviously, there's significant differences, but it's the same Old Testament God, at least. And really, Christianity on one side, and then on the other side is the Islamic faith. They're the only other really major Christian system that you would even claim to have a God that's a personal absolute. So they claim to have a God that's a personal absolute, so does Christianity. The question isn't whether someone claims it, lots of people can claim it, the question is whether it's coherent. This is precisely the Achilles heel with Islam. Think about it for a moment. God is absolute, transcendent, and holy. But God is also personal and wants a relationship with you. There's a little problem in the world. That little problem is called sin. How can a holy, transcendent God also have a personal relationship with His people when there's sin in the world? Well, in the Muslim system, God just says, don't worry about it. Don't worry about the sin, I'll still have a personal relationship with you. Of course, the problem with that is that how in the world can God uphold His transcendent moral law and just let sin go unpunished? The only way you can avoid that problem is if you have some answer to the problem of sin. And this is the very thing that makes Christianity unique. Only Christianity links God's personal nature with His transcendent holiness in a coherent fashion. Only at the cross can God maintain both attributes with any coherence. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, the Muslim God implodes on itself because you try to have a God that relates to its people and maintains a standard of transcendent holiness. How can it do that without some atonement, without some cross? How can you do that without Christ? So at the end of the day, only Christianity stands up as a personal absolute. Now, there's different names for this in theological jargon. I didn't give those to you tonight. To say God is transcendent is to talk about His aseity, right? To say God is transcendent is to talk about His the fact that God is pre-existent and has never sort of started, never began. And so we could talk about all that tonight, but that's just a smidgen of an idea of how important our theology of God plays in our apologetic. Now, there's other things that make Christianity unique. Another example here would probably be the nature of salvation by grace. Only in Christianity is salvation by grace really a coherent concept and a concept that we hold to. That's another thing that we could talk about that makes Christianity unique, and it certainly distinguishes us from the Muslim faith. The other thing that makes Christianity unique is the Bible. Only the Bible is the property of Christians, although Judaism certainly claims the Old Testament, but the Bible itself is a unique thing. But above all this, one of the most unique things about Christianity, obviously, is Christ Himself. He is the most unique thing for us. We always want to be putting Him forward and Him forth because He cannot be competed with. Who can compete with Jesus on any sort of attribute, any sort of quality of any kind? He really sets Christianity as utterly distinctive. So remember, we're comparing worldviews. And to compare worldviews, you have to actually know your own worldview. Think of it like what counterfeiters do. The counterfeiters, if you were to be a guy who works for the government that spots counterfeit bills, your job is not to learn every possible counterfeit bill out there. Why? Because you can never learn enough. There's always a new kind of counterfeiting method. There's always new kind of counterfeit bills. If you want to be a good spotter of counterfeits, what do you learn when you study it? You actually study the real thing, right? You know front and back what a real bill looks like. So when you see a fake, you can spot it instantaneously. In the same fashion, as Christians, we want to make sure that we're immersed in, know, not just at a cursory level, but at an intimate level, the ins and outs of our own Christian system. Now, this doesn't mean you have to get a PhD, but it does mean if you're going to be an effective apologist, it begins not with philosophy. It begins with systematic theology. It begins with understanding what the Bible teaches about a variety of things. Why is that? As I've said from the very beginning of this class, our goal in apologetics is not just to defend sort of vague theism, right? Our goal is to defend distinctively Christian theism. And if we're going to defend distinctively Christian theism, we have to be defending distinctively Christian God. And that means we have to understand what that is composed of. Now, before we leave this point, I want you to notice point B. What can you do with this? Well, here's a term that everyone shies away from. Study. Right? Develop a study plan. Now, most of you who are students right now, and some of you out there are, maybe you're in high school or college or whatever happens to be your thing, and I do plenty of study. I can't do any more. Well, there's always room for more. Some of you think, I haven't picked up a book in a long time. Right? I haven't studied since way back when I was in my undergraduate years. But you know what's interesting? God calls us to love Him not just with our hearts, not just with our actions, but He calls us to love Him with our minds, to absorb His Word. And so it's important that we ask ourselves, how diligent am I at really absorbing, studying, learning, apprehending the Christian faith that God has once and for all delivered to the saints? You know, it is curious that God has decided to reveal Himself in a book. Some of us may not like that. You may not like to read. I can understand that. Everyone has different preferences, but that doesn't change the fact that God has revealed Himself in a book. And there's a sense in which He calls us to absorb that so that we can better represent Him to the world around us. So let me challenge your study plan right now. Some of you may not have one at all. And if you don't, let me encourage you to rethink that. Where in your life can you really dig deep in your preparation, in your understanding, in your knowledge? What things can you do? Where can you get involved here at this church to apprehend more teaching, more understanding, and so forth? Now, the fact that you're here at all during this series is a good thing, right? You're absorbing these things. That's positive. But it has to be ongoing. It has to be consistent in your life. Now, this just isn't devotional time. As important and as foundational as devotional time is, really digging deep may require more than what you're giving right now to devotional time. And so let me encourage you to think through that study plan. I know your pastors and your elders here can give you good suggestions on where to start. Good systematic theology to begin with so you can understand the Christian faith even better. That may sound strange. That's the place to begin for apologetics. But it really is when you understand what apologetics is really about. It's about comparing worldviews. Let me move on to the second Roman numeral you see there in your notes today. A second sort of suggestion and tip as we've put some practical emphasis on our discussion so far, and that is to listen. Learn to listen attentively to the unbeliever's worldview. And one of the things I said at the very beginning of our time together a month ago now was that one of my goals for this class is that you would learn to be able to defend the faith, to adequately represent Christianity without having to know everything. Without having to know every non-Christian worldview out there. And some of you may be thinking, well, how can I do that? Well, this is one of the major ways that's done. One of the major ways that you can interact with any worldview, even if you're not an expert in it, even if you know nothing about it, is to just pick up on this very simple skill of listening. So at this point, the spouses are nudging your other spouse saying, see how important listening is? We need to practice that. Well, here it is. Practice not just with your spouse. Practice this with your non-Christian friend as well and begin to turn attention to these things. So a few points I want you to notice here. First, notice point A. First, just a practical and obvious thing. Listening shows biblical respect to our non-Christian friends. Some of us have this idea that we win an argument by talking the most. You ever met anybody like that? If they think that by definition, if you say more words, that therefore somehow you've achieved victory in this intellectual dispute. Or that if you talk louder than the person that you're speaking with, then that's considered victorious. So either quantity or volume constitutes better intellectual argument. Well, neither, of course, is the case. In fact, you'll realize that you will do yourself a grand disservice by not listening. And one of the first reasons for that is because listening shows biblical respect to your non-Christian friend. How hard is it to have our non-Christians talk to us when we are the ones that are belligerent? We are the ones that are overly argumentative. We are the ones that are constantly interrupting. We are the ones that won't let them speak. We are the ones that are going loud and fast without giving them a chance to talk because we got so much we think we've got to say all the time in our conversation. No, the Bible says you need to learn to interact with our non-Christian friends with gentleness and respect. And we need to give them their chance to speak. There's a second reason, though, and even more important, is that listening allows you to see where the unbeliever's worldview will inevitably self-destruct. Here's the thing about listening when we don't do it, is that we are taking away our greatest weapon. You know what our greatest weapon is when we're talking to our non-Christian friend? Is actually our non-Christian friend. Why? Because he doesn't have a coherent worldview. And if he tries to explain it, if he tries to talk about it, if he is asked to give account for it, what is inevitably going to happen? inevitably he's going to self-implode and contradict himself. How do we know this? We know this by based on the promises of God. God promises that no one who sets himself up against God has a coherent system. No one who has a non-Christian system, that will not fit right together. On the surface, it may look like it fits right. On the surface, it may look very impressive. But God promises us that no system outside the Christian system can give you knowledge, rationality, and coherence. What does that mean? It doesn't matter what view our non-Christian friend has. Whatever view he has, it is not going to hold up at the end of the day. So in fact, when we let our non-Christian friend talk, that actually works in our favor. Why? Because he begins to weave his words into sort of an intellectual noose he eventually hangs himself with. Why? Because he'll realize as he begins to talk that these things don't fit together. This is amazing. You may think this is just something to say, but this really works. Most non-Christians have never, ever had to give an account of their system. Remember the two circles on the board? The reason our non-Christian friends have never given an account of their system is because we've never asked them to do it. All we've done is gone right to the Christian defense and given the Christian answer and said, well, Christianity's not that bad. You know, we're all right. We've got some good answers to things. No, really, listen up. You know, I've got some things I want to tell you. And we think that's good apologetics. Well, that's part of apologetics. But what if you said to the non-Christian friend, hold on a second. Tell me again how in your worldview you determine what is morally right from morally wrong. Explain that to me. Now, you just said one sentence. And for the next 15 minutes, what's going to happen? They're going to fumble around and try to come up with some coherent answer for that question. And they're not going to have one. And you're going to be able to listen and see where their worldview implodes. So don't rob yourself of the greatest weapon that you have in your conversation with your non-Christian friend, which is himself. He cannot make sense of the world as it stands. And you are guaranteed that eventually he's going to weave his arguments into an incoherent fashion. It's inevitably going to self-destruct. Now, there's a third thing here that I want you to see about this before we leave point two, and that is to be aware of intellectual bullying. Let me explain what that is. Thinking intellectual bullying, I thought there was only sort of normal bullying, but there can be intellectual bullying. Some of you may actually come across a non-Christian who knows quite a bit about things. And maybe you haven't had a chance to study a lot about things, and maybe he is a sort of molecular biologist. And he knows all kinds of things about molecular biology. You don't know anything about molecular biology. You think, how could I ever defend the faith against that guy? He's going to have all the arguments for everything. He's going to know all the stuff. If you get in a conversation with someone like that, often what can take place, if someone is an expert in something, is they will try to bully you intellectually by taking their area of expertise and running with it and overwhelming you with data points, knowledge, and information and vocabulary that he knows. And even you know, you cannot keep up with. What do you do in a situation like that? Well, one thing you do is fake it, right? You could pretend that you're tracking, right? Hey, I know what you're saying here. I'm following you. I'm smart too, right? You can make up some fake degrees or something and say that you work at the Johns Hopkins or something. But at the end of the day, that's not going to get you anywhere. What do you need to do? You need to simply be honest and say, look, I don't know that much about molecular biology. Well, I don't know that much about any of the things that you might be talking about, but I'd like to learn more about your worldview. And if you could put it in vocabulary that I could understand, and if we could talk a little more slowly here, I would really like to learn about how your worldview works and how you account for these things. Now, you have to eat a little bit of humble pie there, but what have you forced him to do? You forced him to back off the bullying there and to actually give accounts in ways that you can understand them. And again, eventually, he's going to self-destruct. Even the molecular biologist still has to account for moral norms. He may understand the inner workings of the cell at the micro level, but does that provide the reasons why you should not abuse children? Do the inner workings of cells and the way molecules interact provide moral norms that are transcendent for all humanity? Is that why Hitler was wrong? What is wrong? What is love? What is right and wrong or good and bad? You can be very smart about a lot of things and still not have the answers to the key questions of the universe. And it's true even for someone who wants to bully you intellectually. So, the claim for the Christian is never that we're the smartest. Oftentimes, the truth is we're not. You may not be as smart as your non-Christian friend. You know, that simply doesn't matter. Because you're not dealing with your intelligence level. What you're dealing with is the claims of God in the universe. And what you can always rest in is guess what's on your side? on your side is everything. And when I say everything, I mean literally the entire world God owns. Every fact is His. There's not a single fact that stands against Him. And if there's something that looks like it's against God, then either we've misunderstood it or we've not understood it correctly, because every fact is in His favor because the world is His. Let's move on to the third one here. A third exhortation for you tonight about sort of making this a little more practical. And here's where I'll try to give you some specific examples this evening. And that is learning to challenge your unbelievers' ultimate authority. Learning to challenge the ultimate authority of your non-Christian friends' worldview. Now remember what we talked about way back 4 or 5 weeks ago. Everybody has a worldview. Everybody has a network, a web of beliefs. And everybody has some ultimate standard, some ultimate authority in their system by which they determine good from bad, right from wrong. What do you need to learn to do in an apologetic discussion with your non-Christian friend? You need to learn to find out what that ultimate authority is. So notice point A there in your notes. First, the unbeliever not always acknowledge his ultimate authority. He will not always offer a clear authority. Don't think for a moment in your conversation with your non-Christian friend he's going to start by saying, well, let me start at the beginning by acknowledging my ultimate authority, which is X, Y, and Z, and then we'll have a fruitful conversation. He's not going to do that. I can tell you why. First of all, even if he knew what it was, he probably wouldn't offer it to you on a silver platter. Secondly, and this is most often the reason that's not going to happen in a conversation is because 9 times out of 10, your non-Christian friend doesn't even know what his ultimate authority is. He doesn't even realize he has one. Doesn't even realize you have to have one. Doesn't even realize he has some ultimate reason, some ultimate standard, some epistemological criteria in his system by which he determines these things. Why? Because he's never thought about it. He just says, when you present the resurrection to him, he says, that's crazy. People don't rise from the dead. I'm not going to believe that. Oh, the Red Sea parted? You believe that silly stuff? Now, he just rejects these things out of hand and says, no, that's false. Never has anyone actually got behind his worldview and says, why is it that you think Jesus could not have risen from the dead? Is that because you know that miracles can't happen? And how do you know such a thing? What you quickly find out is that objections to miracles are inherently circular. You ask a person why they don't believe in miracles, and they say, I've never seen a miracle. And then you say, what about all the people who have seen miracles? And the answer is, well, they're all wrong. Well, how do you know they're all wrong? Well, because miracles can't happen. And he's right back where he started again. And so you can see that he just builds it into a system. Now, here you've got a person who has an objection, and you've got to figure out why he has that objection. You want to sniff out his ultimate authority. This is not an easy skill necessarily in apologetics. It's a skill that has to be learned. You have to learn to be a little bit of a detective. You have to learn a little bit, sort of sniff things out and figure things out with your non-Christian friend. Why? Because he doesn't even realize what he's doing. You're talking to a person who's saying things, and he doesn't even fully understand his worldview. You have to actually find out for him what that is often. Now, sometimes it might be obvious. If you're talking to a committed Mormon, maybe the Book of Mormon is his ultimate authority. Or maybe if it's another religious system, it's equally obvious. Maybe it's the Quran or something like this. You can start comparing apples and apples. That's fine. But for the average Joe out there, he doesn't really understand his ultimate authority. It may be science. We'll talk about that guy in a moment. And he may be an empiricist, right? He's committed to certain sort of rules about how you know things. It could be the person's a relativist, right? It could be lots of different systems. The point is you have to find out what it is. And here's the thing. At the end of the day, the ultimate authority for this person, no matter how you construe it, is ultimately simply himself. Simply himself. He is, or she is, the ultimate authority in their own worldview. They're the ones that, in fact, set the standard. They're the ones that determine things. They're the ones that decide what is right and wrong. So here is where we're at a distinctive advantage over our non-Christian friend. Because we want to say to them, okay, hold on, let me ask you something. If you determine what's right and wrong in the world, if you on your own think that you can know things, if you on your own think that you can have assurance, you have a dot of knowledge in the world. Right? That's all you have. How much knowledge do you think there is in the universe? Let's draw this circle. Say this is the universe. That's all the knowledge in the universe. There's a lot of knowledge, a lot of facts out there. How much knowledge do you think your non-Christian friend has in his head? If I were to draw it on here. Maybe I could look at this little speck right there. And maybe that, let's just be generous, all right? Because that's a pretty big speck in this universe. and say, let's imagine that your non-Christian friend has that much knowledge out of all the things that are to know in the universe. What he never, what's never dawned on him is, if you have that much knowledge and all the stuff you don't know, how can you be sure of anything? How do you know, even if you think you're sure of something, that there's not some other fact out there that's going to refute your understanding of things? Our non-Christian friend ought to be perpetually uncertain about everything, including his uncertainty. He ought to have no sense of anything in the world if he really realized where he stands. And of course, he's going to come back to us and he's going to say, well, you're in the same boat I am. Your brain's no bigger than mine. What's our response going to be? You're right. My brain's not any bigger, but what does my worldview have that yours doesn't? Revelation from God. He's going to say, I don't believe in revelation from God, but that misses the point entirely. Doesn't matter whether he believes in revelation from God. The point is that in my worldview, it makes sense why I can make broad claims about reality. I can make broad claims in my worldview about the way things are and the way God is and what's right and wrong, good and bad, and how someone's saved and how they're not. My non-Christian friend also makes enormous truth claims all the time, but he does it on that foundation. The question is simply, which worldview makes more sense? A worldview that makes grand claims, but at least has an authority, namely from God. It makes internal sense to have those grand claims, or to make grand claims and all you have is you. This is the big contrast between us and our non-Christian friend. It's not about how smart we are. It's that we have revelation from God given to us in our system. We believe that we're getting information from a divine being who does have access to all this knowledge. So even though I don't have access to all that knowledge, God does. So can I make sweeping claims about religion in the world? Sure. But not on my own authority. Does your non-Christian friend make sweeping claims about religion? All the time. What are his grounds for it? You have to ask him that. And you find very quickly what his ultimate authority is. And at the end of the day, you know what? It's him. Now that is good news for us, because in any argument, that puts us on great ground. I'm comparing the Christian system to his brain. Now I've got a good situation, right? Because God is always more coherent no matter how smart the brain of my non-Christian friend is. And even if I'm not very smart, I'm not using my brain as the ultimate standard. I'm using God's. Now, when we find out what this ultimate authority is, notice point B. There's two things that we'll find. That ultimate authority will either be arbitrary or inconsistent. These are the two cardinal sins of philosophy, by the way. Arbitrariness and inconsistency. And so we want to look for this in our non-Christian friend's worldview. We want to find out if his worldview is inconsistent or if it's utterly arbitrary. And the truth of the matter is it's actually going to be both, oftentimes. Now, you can see there in your notes, I've given you, there's a few examples of this. Let me just mention these. First, let's imagine you're having lunch with your empiricist friend. You can see that first example. You're trying to convince him that Christianity is true. And your empiricist friend is a scientist. He thinks, you know, I don't believe anything unless you can prove it to me scientifically. If you can prove it to me scientifically, then maybe I'll believe it. Now, at this point, we have a choice. Either we can, A, try to prove it to him scientifically, or we can take a different route. If we try to prove it to him scientifically, you think that's going to work very well? Nah, unlikely, even though Christianity has great evidence for it. Our non-Christian friends already decided certain evidence is not allowable. Certain evidence isn't believable. So, doubtful he's going to believe it that way. But what if I took a different tact in my conversation? What if I tried to find out what his ultimate authority was? And I found out his ultimate authority is science. And I find out that this is what my non-Christian friend believes. All truth comes through science. A lot of people believe this, even if they haven't articulated it that way. And I whittle it down and realize this is my non-Christian friend's ultimate standard. This is what he believes. And like I said, I have a choice. This is his standard. I can try to meet it. Oh, this is your standard for truth. Let me try to show you how Christianity meets it. We've already said that's going nowhere. Why? Because he has a standard for truth that's never going to give Christianity credibility. Now, I would suggest to you that our methodology will take a very different tact here. Instead of simply trying to say, hey, let me try to meet your standard, we're going to do something very different. We're going to challenge it. We're going to take the wrecking ball to that, intellectually speaking. We're going to find out what his ultimate authority is, and we're going to take all our artillery, and we're going to put it right on that thing, and we're going to blow it out of the water. We're going to ask, where does that come from? My friend who sits across from the table from me, I want to ask him this question. How do you know this? How do you know all truth comes through science? Now, once you ask him that, something begins to happen. Why? Because no one's ever asked him that before. And he will quickly find himself on the horns of a dilemma. Here's what the dilemma is. All truth comes through science. How do you know? We ask. He has two choices. One choice is science. What's the problem with this? Well, one, it's to some extent circular, right? As in, all truth comes through science. I got that from science. I didn't really answer the ultimate question, but there's a bigger problem with this. If he says, I got all truth from science, can you show that from science? Can you show scientifically that all truth comes through science? Can you observe every instance of knowledge in the entire universe to know that every instance of knowledge only and always comes through science? You can never show that scientifically. You have to be omniscient to know that. What does that say? That says this just simply doesn't work. Knowledge, is it circular? But it just simply won't pan out on a scientific level. So he has another option. Not science. What's wrong with that? He just contradicted himself. All truth comes through science. How do you know that? Oh, I know that because for some other reason. But then you didn't get that through science. So in other words, all truth doesn't come through science, and you just refuted yourself. You can't say all truth comes through science, but the question is, where does this come from? And the answer he gives is not from science. What has happened? He's just simply imploded on his own worldview. In other words, he has an ultimate standard that's entirely arbitrary. He just likes the standard. Just plucks it out of thin air and says, I'm going to make this my standard, and here it is. I'm going to make this my standard. I think I'll just have this standard. All truth comes through science. Where do I get it from? I don't know. I don't get it from anywhere. I don't get it through science. I just get it. Give me a freebie intellectually, right? Give me some freebie starting point. What we want to show him is you don't get freebie starting points. This entire premise completely implodes on itself. Now, imagine you're still at lunch with a non-Christian friend. How different does your conversation look now than if you tried to show how scientific Christianity was? Because if you try to show how scientific Christianity was, you'd be getting nowhere. Are you getting somewhere here? Yeah, because his worldview is falling to pieces all around him. He realizes, you know, I really don't have any foundation for how I know what I know. Let me give you a second example. This is our relativist friend, and we all have these. And I'm going to give you actually a real-life example here. I clipped this article from the newspaper years ago. Not to pick on our friend Hillary Clinton, but it happens to be a quote from her, so I'll just leave that aside for the moment. This article came out in 1997 in the Arizona Republic, and it's about abortion. And it says, apparently someone had bombed an abortion clinic, and it said, bomb stokes, abortion fires anew. And they're interviewing all these folks in here. And there's a priceless quote from Ms. Clinton in here. They're interviewing everybody, and they interview Hillary Rodham Clinton, and this is what she says. This is never an easy issue, says Clinton. Anyone who thinks they have ultimate truth is going to be wrong. Say that one more time. Apparently she needs to say that one more time. Anyone who thinks they have ultimate truth is going to be wrong. It's amazing is how many people read that and never realize how utterly incoherent that statement is. And how internally contradictory that statement is. She's basically saying no one has ultimate truth. And if they do say they have ultimate truth, then they're wrong. And that implies, what does Hillary Clinton have? Ultimate truth. Apparently she's the exception to her own rule in this particular instance. I might as well write this sentence on the board. All sentences are false. This is the equivalent of her statement. All sentences are false. Is that a true statement? Well, if it's false, then it's false. And if it's true, then it's false. Correct? This is what relativism does. Relativism is a worldview that says there is no absolute truth, and that you make up your own absolute truth. And even when they declare the statement, there is no absolute truth, imagine that statement. There is no blank. That's a fairly emphatic statement. It's a fairly absolute statement. And the person who just said there's no absolutes just made that statement, and doesn't realize at all the utter incoherence of their own system. What's amazing is that this passes as normal rhetoric in our society, and people all the time not only talk this way, but think this way. And so when you talk with your non-Christian friend, your job is simply to point these things out, not in a mean fashion, but just simply saying, now hold on, let me get this straight. You said a minute ago that there's no absolute truth, everyone kind of do their own thing and have their own standards, yes.
But then at this other time, he said these other people were wrong. But help me understand that.
You realize very quickly that they will have no coherent answer to your question. So point C there on this third point is you have to learn to ask the right questions. At the end of the day, you've got to be a good detective. Be able to go in and figure out where their worldview is and what the ultimate authority is and turn all your artillery on that ultimate authority and destroy it intellectually speaking, of course. Let's look at the last Roman numeral here, number four. As time slips away from me here, I'm not going to have the time to get into this as much as I wish we could. And sorry for letting the time slip away as we try to get to this last point. But notice the last point. Point out how the unbeliever lives inconsistently with his own worldview and actually borrows from the Christian system. This last point has to do with the practice of our non-Christian friend. How he lives. We want to say, hold on a second, you profess one thing in your worldview, but you actually live and act like another worldview were true. Actually, you kind of live and act like our worldview was true. You kind of live and act like the Christian worldview was true, and that there really was a God who gave moral norms so that you can talk about right and wrong. If there really is a God who controls the world and upholds nature so that it's uniform and predictable and so on. And so what happens here is we realize the unbeliever is in a very difficult situation. Our non-Christian friend is between two worlds. There's God's world, and then there's his world that he's made up in his mind. In fact, he lives in the real world, but he tries to insist that his own idea of what the world's like is really real, and our non-Christian is stuck between these two points. And he's got tension back and forth. What is the tension caused by? Well, he has to live in God's world. That's a pretty hard thing to do when you have a world that you've made up in your own mind, and it doesn't fit. And so he's always going back and forth. He's always living in a world of tension, in a world of inconsistency. So on one level, he wants to say, hey, you know, it's just matter and motion in the world, and everybody can do their own thing, and different strokes, different folks, and you don't pose your morality on me. You've heard that statement. But the next thing you know, he's out there, you know, picking it against environmental pollution and how wrong it is and how we need to change our laws and make sure that people don't pollute the environment. Then you want to tap him on the shoulder and say, now, hold on a second. Didn't I just hear you say different strokes, different folks, and everybody gets to kind of do their own thing? Well, which one is it? And you'll find that your non-Christian friend is caught between two worlds. He wants moral norms, and so he knows there's moral norms in God's world, but then he professes in his own world there isn't. He's caught between these two things. One of the greatest strategies in apologetics is to just simply point this out to him. You cannot live consistently with your own worldview. If you were to try to live like your worldview were true, you'd be left in utter incoherence. Let's imagine the Mormon is the person we're talking to. What if he tried to live consistently with his own worldview? Well, in his own worldview, there's a bunch of multiple gods on their old planets, and they all make their own laws, so theoretically it could be another god on another planet who makes a different law, exactly opposite, and calls that law good. So theoretically, a god on another planet could decree that torturing little children is good, and you'd have to concede it is. Utterly incoherent. And so what we want to do is we want to point out here to our non-Christian friend that he cannot live in God's world and his own world at the same time. He's caught in this tension here. And again, I wish we had more time in our example here. I mentioned the example in your notes of sexual immorality. We could point out how he wants to have freedom in areas of sexual morality, but then when it comes to other areas, he wants to lay down the law on moral norms. What's interesting about our non-Christian friend is he's not actually interested in being consistent. He wants to have things set up exactly like he wants them. So when it comes to sexual morality, everybody can do their own thing. But when it comes to other things, he's got this moral code that comes from who knows where. He's arbitrarily applying it. So what we want to do is we want to point out that he is actually living off of the Christian worldview. He's actually borrowing from the Christian worldview, but not giving God credit for it. You'll see there at the very bottom, and again, apologize for the time as it ticks away. Notice the very last line in your notes there. All of life is an opportunity for apologetics. How does your non-Christian behave? He often behaves like God is real. So let me give you a couple examples of this. Does your non-Christian friend balance their checkbook? Maybe not, right? Depending on who you talk to. But let's imagine you found one that did. Do you have to be a Christian to balance your checkbook? No. But what you want to point out to him is that when he balances his checkbook, he actually is assuming logic, because numbers are logical implications, and he's also assuming the uniformity of nature, that things work in an orderly, predictable, almost numerical, logical fashion. But in his own worldview, where does he have a foundation for those things? In other words, he's balancing a checkbook, but to even do that presupposes the Christian view of the world. He's actually acting. Even when he does something as mundane as balancing his checkbook, he's actually borrowing God's system for that to have any coherence at all. How about, you ever had a neighbor who gardens? Gets out there and maybe does their little gardening and plants and flowers? What if you walked over there in their yard and asked them, so, I see you're watering your plants. So how come today you didn't say, pour gasoline on it? And of course, they'd look at you like, what? What are you talking about? And you're like, well, why didn't you pour gasoline on your plants today instead of water? And their answer is, because plants live off water. And then you ask, did you check today if they lived off water? Have you tested today if plants live off water? Or are you just assuming the future will be like the past? The answer is they're assuming the future will be like the past. Well, what grounds do you have for assuming that? I don't know. Here's the thing to realize is that things like gardening presuppose the Christian worldview. You couldn't do it. You wouldn't make any sense without God. What does that mean? What that means is actually all of life is an opportunity for apologetics. Everything your non-Christian friend does is ultimately contradictory, him caught between two worlds. In one world, he wouldn't necessarily be able to balance his checkbook, but he still does, because God's world is real. Now, this doesn't mean you follow your non-Christian friend around and point these things out to him all day, right, and pester the poor guy. You jump out of the bushes, you know, it's, ah, gotcha, you know. That's not the point. The point, though, is that he does this, and at the proper times, you want to simply point out how he lives one way, but if his worldview were true, he could never actually do that. What does that mean? That means in his heart, he really does know God. And Romans 1 is right. He knows God and suppresses that knowledge and unrighteousness. Okay, we're out of time tonight. Let me just see if there's a couple quick questions at the end here. And then I'll close this in prayer. Any questions? These were just some tips, suggestions, angles, examples for you tonight. Yes. Sure. Mm-hmm. That's a bit of a mix. What I'm always amazed by is the claim that, yeah, we should hold nothing with assurance. And I'm like, how do you know that for sure? Would be the next question. Okay. So it's sort of like the skeptic who says, you should be skeptical about everything. Really? Are you skeptical about whether you should be skeptical about everything? Skepticism is its own Achilles heel. At the end of the day, just utterly incoherent. A person goes, yeah, we know nothing for sure. Another objection I'd raise to that individual is like, it's funny how you can know nothing for sure, but you're sure Christianity is false. Where's the humility, intellectually speaking, if you know nothing for sure and things are always changing? What he wants to do is be unsure about certain things and dogmatic about others. Let's be honest. And the question is, well, what determines which ones you're dogmatic about and which ones you're not? And that's where I would go with that particular one. Yep. Yeah. People say that all the time. And so my response is, well, why should you do what society does? Why should you follow society? That would be one answer. If society determines what is morally right and wrong, another response to that is, then theoretically, another 1,000 years, society could deem torturing little children as good. You'd have to agree.
Yeah, he does agree.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, then, if he does, if you have a person who's willing to go the distance there, okay, then you've got him in a corner, because now you can say, okay, so you have no objection to Hitler, you have no objection to Stalin, and then if he says, you're right, I don't think they were wrong in what they did, okay, then I would just get the microphone out and say that loud for everyone to see. And I would tell everyone, see where non-belief leads you. Non-belief will ultimately, if followed consistently, lead to Stalin, Hitler, no problem, and yeah, you could torture little children, it would still be good. The funny thing is he doesn't live that way. And the funny thing is he doesn't want anyone else to either.
Well, the society exists and doesn't believe
that. Yeah. That's right. Besides, if society met, you know, society did construct moral norms, and that made it morally right. And of course, Hitler's Germany was morally right in slaughtering the Jews, and so on and so forth. Any of the last questions, comments? All right. Am I correct that it's 8? Is everyone seeing that? My watch has been acting up lately, so I haven't seen kids running in the yard yet. So that's usually my cue that our time is up. All right, I'll be up here for questions if you want to chat with me individually as we wrap up tonight. Let me close this in prayer. Lord, we thank you that the world is yours and that you guarantee that you control it and that all things point to you. And ironically, Lord, even unbelief, even the actions of the unbeliever point to you. They so cannot avoid you that they even point to you when they reject you. And Lord, we thank you for that. Help us to be good witnesses for you in a dark place in this world, Lord, that we'd be a light that shines for your glory. We pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.